CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
People being willing to give me the money, I think. And
right.
Yeah. True. Writing, yeah.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And today we have a very special guest. It is Corinna Faith, who has written and directed a movie called The Power, coming out on VOD, digital HD, and DVD on September 21st. Corinna, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It still makes me very happy hearing that list of information that I have actually there in the world. It's very nice.
Yes. So the title of this movie is very simple, but it has a lot of different meanings to it. Could you discuss the meaning of the power in this movie?
Well, the literal meaning is that the story takes place in over one night during a power cut in a hospital. A rolling blackouts that took place in the 1970s in the UK. Enforced blackouts. The film is very much about power dynamics and who has the power and who doesn't, and a character starting with very little power and where she goes with that. So, I mean, you can come at it from, as you say, many directions.
Yeah. The blackouts, I read a little bit on this stuff. This is, was it something about mining, miners, that the coal production wasn't as much, I guess, that the reason for the blackouts, like it was a forced blackout?
Well, yeah, the simple version is that the unions, the workers' unions, which were very powerful at the time in the 1970s, were demanding better rights and pay. And they were in conflict with the government, and they were making threats to hold the production of power to the country, hold it back. And the government retaliated by saying, okay, we won't use so much power and we'll have power cuts. So there was on and off rolling blackouts over those 2 years.
What was your inspiration for this film?
It was a bunch of things that came together, really. I was looking for something to write a ghost story about, which is perhaps harder than it sounds. They're quite... simple little delicate things, I think, but not necessarily often enough to sustain something meaty. And I was interested in setting it in the 70s simply because I'm interested in 70s horror. And I was just curious and thinking about that world. And then at the same time, horribly, there was quite a variety of big scandals breaking in the news about institutional abuse that had been hidden for decades, and a number of these were emanating from the 70s. I mean, it was a mixture of things, but there was a really big key one with a presenter called Jimmy Savile. I don't know if you're aware of that story. He was a very iconic he was hugely iconic British TV presenter who everyone who was young in the 70s knew about him, and he worked with children basically, and he also had access to at all. So it was a very disturbing story. They were all very disturbing and in real world terms, very horrifying. So I was feeling just a lot of sadness about the young lives and all the lost voices and hidden voices that were involved in these scandals. And that concealment felt like a ghost story. So that was the territory. And then I was looking around at that era for visuals and came across this amazing image of a woman working in the 1970s at a desk job, being a secretary, but she was in total darkness and lit by an oil lamp. And it was such a kind of Victorian Gothic ghost story type image, but it was in the 70s. And then I realized there was this perfect crossover with the kind of Gothic tradition, which I love, and that time. And that's how it all came together.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's a foreshadowing of some sort where you look at the air conditioning ducts in in this hospital, and there's this black dust coming out of it, and it doesn't look like it's been cleaned for years. Your supernatural entity in this movie, Gail, you sort of blanket her in darkness all the way throughout. And this blackout, these rolling blackouts, are a way for her to come out into this hospital.
Yeah.
This is what you were sort of, trying to accomplish with this character?
Yeah. I had this sense of, people and their voices that had been hidden. And kind of locked away into darkness. And that felt that kind of gave me the structure for the whole idea, that in a way, the more dark it was in our story, the more present Gail can be and the more she can access and have this very extreme relationship with our protagonist and reach out to her. It was the combination of the psychology of darkness and this concealment of things that are all around us that we shut off and don't want to see, and just the literal fear of the dark.
Yeah. I imagine that's a challenging thing to shoot your movie, like, I guess 50% of it or more is in darkness all the way through.
Yeah, that was a challenge. It was a fun challenge with my DP, Laura Bellingham, trying to work out what darkness can be, because we didn't want it to be one thing all the way through, because we thought it would be quite exhausting to watch if it was just constantly straining to see what was going on. And really, in film, there is so many degrees of darkness, and that sometimes, like, in some films, somebody will be running through a forest in the middle of the night and it will be bright, bright kind of blue light. You kind of get away with all sorts of dark in a film. We did want moments where it really is intense for the audience as well, and you're really struggling to see what's going on in the way that Val would be. But there are lots of other degrees of it all the way through. And we tried to think about where the light moments were going to be literally as well. It was quite technically challenging working with the very unreliable gas lamps and dark corridors.
Yeah. This is your feature debut?
Yeah. It is. Yeah. It's been
What clicked for you to get to this point where you were ready to direct a full length motion picture?
People being willing to give me the money, I think, and writing. Right.
Yeah.
True. Writing, I mean, you need that. It's an expensive thing trying to make a film, but just the coming together of all those elements. So having enough confidence from the industry and a script that made sense to the financiers who backed the project. And you need all those pieces to align. Great producers that I had helping me for years beforehand to keep it going and put it together. So a lot of persistence, I think, and resilience was the main ingredient.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk about your cast and your lead. Rose Williams is who plays Val is terrific in this. Mm-hmm. She's instantly, there's just something in her eyes or something like that, that you know that she is a kind and caring person throughout this. But Val has to go through some stuff in this where she's writhing on the floor and doing a lot of physical acting and everything. I was just wondering if Rose Williams was okay after the filming of this movie, because she seemed to do a lot of crazy stuff in this.
That is a good question.
Tell us about your cast.
Well, just to focus on Rose for a minute, because I personally think the whole cast are really fantastic, and we just really lucked out with everyone that signed up for it, and my brilliant casting director, Carlene Crawford, who's got fantastic taste. But Rose, mm-hmm. in terms of what you just said about something in her eyes, that was exactly the experience I had. I saw a tiny little clip of her. She was in the States at the time, and she did a little record along with a whole bunch of other people. And instantly I just thought, that is somebody you can really empathize with. She brought a pathos to the character that I thought was so valuable, because mm-hmm. we have so little time with her, especially at the beginning. So to get on her side is incredibly useful and a great way into the story, the quite dark story for the audience. So that was quite special, the way that she was cast, really. And she was clearly very collaborative when we had our casting conversations, very much had her own take on why she wanted to do it, which was really important to me. Because I was super aware that I didn't want to just put someone through the mill and just, you know, make it an endurance test, because it's a very intense part, as you say. Mm. And I wanted her to come out whole and in a good place on the other side, and not to be kind of put on a condition of getting a great leading woman and then completely destroying them, which has happened a little bit, I think, in the past with these some of these intense roles. So I felt that she had the resilience and the ambition for it herself. And then she really took the whole thing on, did a lot of her own research, and wanted to do her own stunts. So everything in the film, apart from one moment where there's a smash and some glass, is actually Rose performing the stunts herself.
Wow.
We did a lot of workshopping, 2 days of putting together this big key possession scene without giving too much away, which is pretty wild. But she had actually choreographed that with me learned it. So she's actually, although it's very extreme, she pushed herself to the absolute fullest. She knew what she was doing, and she knew what each movement was going to be. So there's a kind of control in the madness of it.
Yeah, I would think that it's not only difficult to choreograph such a thing, but, you know, when you say that it's kind of mapped out and everything, it's also hard not to make it look like it's mapped out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know what the trick is there. How, you know?
I think that is entirely down to the performance. I mean, there's only so much that myself and Laura, the DP, could do. We were just capturing on that day what she was putting out there, and she really went for it on that day. So
yeah. Yeah, she certainly did.
Yeah. So that is all her.
Really. I think a lot of times it's easy, because we've seen so many horror movies, to think, oh well. I mean, you don't really think about these type of things. But I was sitting there going, oh my God, this must have been just physically exhausting.
She
had to take a big, huge break between takes or whatever. I don't know, but it's pretty amazing what she
did. It was without doubt a tough few days for her emotionally, because I think what you can't hide and what the camera captures is that that's an emotionally intense performance as well. She's not just throwing herself around. She was very brave with the kind of places that she went to mentally and emotionally, and felt really massively aligned with the themes, and felt that they were really important to her as well. So I think that's one of the reasons she was willing to push herself so far.
And you mentioned that the rest of your cast is great too. Shakira Rachman, I think that's how you pronounce it. Plays you know, I can't remember the character name. Sorry,
Saba, the character,
the 13-year-old girl.
Yeah, Saba.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she speaks a little bit of English, not much, but she keeps wandering away, and we're wondering what's wrong with her. She's great in this, as well as Daveen Henry.
Yes, Daveen. Yeah. They were both absolutely brilliant.
She's awesome, and Emma Catherine Rigby, who plays the sort of the nurse rival, basically, in the movie.
Yeah, poor Babs.
Yeah. you know, this is a what. So, how did you find these people? I'm sure it's through the normal casting process. They auditioned and everything, but what did you see in them?
With the older actors, they were found through our casting agent. Daveen, she's just, I think she's really striking. I met her with a few different people. I didn't meet her. This was on a tape, and it was just something about the recording or the light or something. I wasn't sure that she looked old enough for the part. So I was wavering and not going for it, even though I could see she was great, because I had a specific kind of age in mind for this character. And she bumped into my casting agent and said to her, "Look, I'm supposed to do this role. This is my role. And I really think you should." And when I heard that, I was like, perfect. That's amazing. So yeah, it should be your role, because she was obviously bringing so much to it herself. So yeah, she was fantastic. But with Shakira, it was much harder to find somebody, because again, it was very specific. So Carlene and her team had to do a big, wide call out that was nothing to do with drama schools or agencies. And she was found a different way. I think it was through her school in the end. And she is so far from the character that you see on screen. She's a really natural, instinctive actor, because you can't tell, but she's a very, very sassy East London girl. Doesn't speak that language at all. Had to learn it all for the film. She's very contemporary. So that's how good she is. And her and Rose just really clicked and had a lot of fun together and looked after each other. And Shakira just made us laugh all the way through. So when you're dealing with such a dark content, that was a real joy.
This institution, this hospital is ridiculously toxic. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's almost unbelievable, but I mean, this is, I think almost every man in this hospital is got some sort of, they're bad people. It's a scary place to work at, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is unbelievable in that it's not real and it's a very heightened version.
Right. Yeah.
It's really kind of thematic. But I would add as well that I suppose what I was interested in is the many different ways in which all kinds of people play into toxic institutional situations where vulnerable people fall between the cracks. And yes, there is somebody awful who's a perpetrator, but for a large bunch of people, for it to happen this as often as it has done, it's much more complex than that. And sadly, many of us will be playing some kind of role in that, even if it's just finding it too difficult to engage with. So with the female characters, I was also thinking about their responses and how they're involved really in the oppression, however subtly.
Yeah.
Really the only character who's fully redemptive in the story is Matron, because she's able to kind of deal with the reality and then do something with it, but nobody else can.
Yeah. It is kind of like there are nurses here who seem institutionalized, where they just kind of, oh, well, that's boys being boys and we'll just deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a big deal. And then they don't even believe people when they say that there's something wrong going on here. And especially with this character who, you know, we learn a lot about her early years, who just sort of comes up to, we finally learn the ultimate truth later, but she had a similar situation where she was not believed early on in her years. And it's well known that she did this. And so it adds an extra, you know, layer of incredulity to everybody else in the institution. I don't know how you fight against that stuff. I mean, you need a Gale in your life almost, right? To fight against these kind of things.
Yeah. Well, I suppose there are Gales out in our world. That's another thing that the story is very much talking about, is that unfortunately as a society, we haven't believed women when they've spoken up about things or children. And that isn't a male or female thing. That's a societal group thing. But it's been very dominant and huge. And I guess it's such a heartbreaking, exhausting thing to see. And this story is a kind of cathartic smashing of that, if you know what I mean. I mean, they find a breakthrough, and she is heard in a way. It was very much circling around those ideas.
And just the casual way, I mean, it sounds like an innocuous remark, but one of the doctors, the one that Val sort of befriends in the movie, casually says something like, he gets her in trouble basically because she's not supposed to talk to doctors because doctors are above them and so on and so forth. And he takes a shine to her and then he's like, oh yeah, I'm sorry, I got you in a little trouble there. They kind of let us do whatever we want here as doctors. And it's an innocuous remark, but it's also a dangerous remark in the movie that comes back it comes to roost, so to speak.
Yeah, I think there's not a huge amount of dialogue in the film, but nearly all of it is about the little ways that people have power over each other, even if it seems innocent.
Yeah.
Particularly the whole front half, everyone's kind of stating their position.
Right.
Val frequently finds herself on the wrong end of that, the losing end. Coming in thinking that she does have some, that she's earned the right to be there, and she wants to impress, and she's got some status in a way, but that's very quickly undermined, which I think is the difficult thing about institutional setups. I think it pits people against each other in that way. And that's very much what everyone's doing.
I think it's also interesting how you play the idea that her wanting to be helpful and her wanting to actually, you know, what she believes nurses should be doing, gets her into trouble with other nurses, basically. Like they kind of judge her for that, you know. Babs, I don't know. I guess she kind of misspeaks to Babs a little bit, but Babs takes something the wrong way. And then the other two nurses, the ones that are with the babies, they ask her why she wanted to be a nurse. And she's like, because to help people. And then they just kind of laugh at her. And then I think that affects how they deal with her later, too, in some ways, which is I thought was fascinating as far as characters.
I suppose politics or all sorts of things, there is this kind of jaded feeling once you're really engaged with it that you can't change the system. And that's the really dangerous thing, isn't it? Because then it becomes more important to toe the line, because otherwise you're going up against things and it's just going to be a personal cost to you when you can't actually have any individual impact. And that's been the amazing thing about the Me Too movement, hasn't it? And Black Lives Matter smashing that concept, really, and just refusing to toe the line. So this story was actually written quite a long time before those movements erupted over the last few years, but it's been very interesting to think about it in relation to that.
What was your hardest day on set, Corinna? What was the one that you're like, I'm going to quit movies forever?
Oh. I definitely didn't ever feel that. I really absolutely relished it despite all the stress.
It's the problem solving, right?
Yeah, I love the problem solving. I absolutely just was in heaven working with the crew, and I had been writing on my own for years. So it was just so fantastic to just see this story world that had been in my head coming to life through other people's talents and ideas. And that was just so just exhilarating. So even at my worst days, still some good moments, but there was a couple of, it was very tight schedule, very little time, as most directors, especially low budget directors, will tell you that's a really big challenge. And we were working in a particular part of the hospital, which everyone in the end up, not everyone, but some people in the end felt like was the haunted part of the building. There's quite a few weird things happening.
Yep.
A generator broke down. We only had a day in that part of the hospital to shoot, so that was really bad, and we lost a lot of time. We managed to get another generator. That broke down as well. Third generator.
Oh, wow.
By this point, we'd lost nearly the entire day, which is huge. Shoot. And then
it's like you were actually filming in the 70s for a day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So first generators, which was not a good one. And then we had another day that was just the cursed gas lamp day, where it just kept breaking all the way through, and we lost about half a day to a gas lamp. So, you can't predict what's going to be tricky, but that's what it was.
You actually shot in a hospital, or was there a set for a lot of it?
No, it's a real hospital. It took us, we were just very lucky because we were looking for years for the right place, and I couldn't find anything that I thought had enough scale, because there was quite a lot of scale written into the story, into the script, long corridors and enough space for the light to fall into total dark, which was really important. And then this place became fully available. Lots more corridors opened up and stuff, and it was completely decommissioned as an NHS hospital just before the shoot, a few weeks before. So I was very lucky. It was a Victorian psychiatric hospital. So it's very old, had been used by the NHS in lots of different ways. And then, like I say, had just been finally closed its doors to its last types of patients. So we had the run of the place, but it's a very atmospheric kind of sad building, really, because it's got so much feels like it has quite a lot of heartbreak in it, but space in terms of the scale and the shapes and the corridors. So it was so fun to film there. And then we created our wards, designed them in the way that we wanted to, with all the exact color palettes and stuff within wards that were already there, and just kind of changed the shape. So it was fantastic in the end, and I think it feels like another character in the story, which is what I wanted.
Yeah, that's something that you'll notice right off the bat in this movie is you have that you take the camera towards the map of the levels that they're on, and And then the camera then starts to show you all the corridors around, and especially in that one scene where the power is going out, where she mm-hmm. sees the one huge dark corridor and then one lit up corridor that's about to be dark. You suddenly get that's the part in the movie where you're just like, oh no, she's going to be in the complete dark. How does she even get through any of this? I understand why you waited. I now understand why you waited so long to get the set that you wanted, because if you don't have that, then kind of get a claustrophobic feel maybe, but you don't, it doesn't have the same effect.
Yeah. Which is why we kept looking and looking, and that particular image was in the script from the very beginning. That's probably one of the only things that stayed from draft one to draft however many. Mm-hmm. And everybody luckily agreed that we really did need to try and find that scale, because also you just want to feel like this little character is swallowed up by this building and this institution and up against it in so many ways. And really small in that massive darkness. So yeah, you wouldn't get the same effect if you didn't have these huge long spaces.
Was there ever a point where somebody was like, all right, well, we're just going to have to get the best possible one that we can possibly get right now? Or were you just like, never, I'm not going to make this?
Well, okay. Matt and Rob, my producers, they kept having to flag that because that was the reality we were facing. But actually, we had Good Maze, which was this hospital, in our mix. But I mm-hmm. was reluctant because only a few bits of it were available. And I was concerned that we just wouldn't have enough control over the environment and I wouldn't be able to create the visual world I wanted, because we wouldn't be able to paint it and really control the tone and the look of the film. So I was resisting. But then, just like I say, suddenly they said, oh, well, we're actually closing the whole building so you can have the whole place.
Locations must be just a nightmare sometimes, right? We just talked to somebody who did a movie called The Last Matinee, where he shot at an actual movie theater, and he had to come in like during the last showing of The Lion King at a real theater and start setting up cameras and lighting and stuff like that. And it's like, man, there's so many things that you have to worry about on these.
Exactly.
Things.
Yeah. So that's what I was trying to avoid, really, was having to work around actual patients and their opening hours of the surgeries that were in there. That would have been a nightmare.
Oh God.
Yeah. So I feel for the other director. It's tough. But the locations are so important. And the other thing that I, big ambition I had for this project was that I really wanted to find and work in somewhere real that actually had a genuine atmosphere that we would try and capture mm-hmm. the images and try and kind of transmit it to the audience for that extra layer of atmosphere and anxiety. And for Rose to have that to work with as well and draw on. And that place just had bucket loads of it. So, it couldn't have been better, really.
It certainly does. The basement, was the basement like that? Or did you have to dress it up a little bit?
Yeah, no, the basement we created, I mean, actually the whole hospital is effectively a bungalow. It's all on one level. It's just one really big.
Oh, really?
Yeah, long spread out building. So we shot the staircases in another building. And we had to just manufacture the sense that it's multi-level, which is why I had the idea for the map and to try and kind of, you know, trick the audience into buying that this place has lots of levels and that she's stuck up on the top.
I bought it.
She's right down. Good. So the basement is actually the basement's on the ground floor with windows. The production designer Fran Mazurial did a fantastic job just gathering together tons of crazy junk and blacking it all out and making it feel like it should be underground.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like you had a really, really good time with the changing some of the, you know, the making the hospital your own thing, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was quite amazing. I mean, a lot of that is down to the amazing art department and production designer, Fran. They just really, I was just very much in sync with all my HODs. So that is the kind of massive piece of luck that you sometimes get, I suppose, that they could just read exactly what I was talking about and what I wanted. And we were very much in sync. So they created the space exactly as I imagined it, really.
Yeah. What an awesome feeling that must be. Mm-hmm. Especially it's your feature debut and you get something like that to work just the right way. I mean, you could obviously run it. You could have bad people that work with you or something that just that don't know what they're doing. And then, whatever, but you sound like you found the right people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, that's great producers to line up the right people, but yeah, it could easily be scuppered by the wrong personality with you, but luckily we didn't have any of that.
Yeah, well, you were talking about atmosphere, and you also mentioned earlier your enjoyment of 70s horror. Was there any specific influences? I mean, I'm Chris and I both are huge 70s horror guys, so and I definitely felt that while I was watching this.
Well, it's not obvious at all, but Let's Scare Jessica to Death is a bit of a favorite.
That is the movie I thought of while I was watching this.
Oh, really? That is really so weird. I mean, I don't know how. What? It's just that, I mean, there's no literal comparison, but there's something about that.
No.
And the kind of neurosis of the central female character and the place she goes to and that kind of descent. And the very strange heightened atmosphere that I've always been very drawn to.
Yeah, I couldn't really pinpoint why, but like that was one I was thinking about. I think it's just the, you know, you don't really know exactly who's trying to do what, like what's like, if there are people trying to do something to her, or you don't exactly know what's going on for a while. So I think that's the main thing.
Yeah.
And, I think the characters are kind of similar.
Yeah, that's true. And in Let's Scare Jessica to Death, like you say, you don't really know who you should be most afraid of.
Yes.
And that is a really
incredible
thing about that film. and whether it could she should be scared of herself more than anyone else in a way, which is, there's a similarity between that and The Power as well. That's so interesting.
That's cool. Well, I'm glad I wasn't wrong.
And then also, they're not horror films, but they're disturbing. The two early Robert Altman films, Images and Three Women, they were big in terms of sound design and kind of quite informative with my visual approach and the palette. And we took a lot of stills from those films and looked at them and they fed into the production design and the cinematography a lot. That was awesome. Fun because I didn't know much about his early body of work. So I was excited to discover that and realize that it was what a lot of what I was trying to do was there to learn from.
Oh, that's awesome. I watched this movie with a pair of headphones. So I got, you know, the full effect of the voices that were talking during the movie, like the voices that maybe is in her head or maybe not or whatever. And that's awesome. It's amazing what you draw influence from sometimes, right? Like it's not horror movies, but here's something where they did something that I ended up felt inspired by and did in my own film. So that's amazing.
I mean, the sound design in the 1970s, like with Images, which is very kind of overt and disturbing, that is very present in this film, I'd say.
The movie is The Power. We'd like to thank Corinna Faith for giving us her time. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thank you for watching.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be on VOD, digital HD, DVD on September 21st. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.